Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to BT's results conference call for the first quarter ending 30th of June 2016. My name is Grant MacArthur, and I'm your coordinator for today. Throughout the presentation, you will remain on listen only. If you need assistance at any time during the call, please key star then zero on your telephone keypad, and a coordinator will be pleased to assist you. I would like to advise all parties today's conference is being recorded today. And now I would like to hand you over to the company.
Thanks and welcome, everyone. My name is Carl Murdoch-Smith, and I'm the IR Director for BT. On the call today, we have Gavin Paterson, Chief Executive, and Tony Shanmugam, our former Group Finance Director. In the room, we also have Simon Ralph, who is our new Group Finance Director and the CEOs of our lines of business. Before we start, I'd like to draw your attention to the usual caution on forward-looking statements. Please see the slide that accompanies today's call and our latest annual report in Form 20F, for examples of the factors that could cause actual results to differ from any forward-looking statements we may make. Both the slide and the annual report can be found on our website. I'll now hand over to Gavin.
Thanks, Carl, and good morning, everyone. And turning to slide four. We've made a good start to the year with growth in revenue and strong cash generation. The integration of EE is going to plan, and Tony will take you through this in more detail later. But we're already starting to see the benefits from this acquisition, as well as from the wider business reorganisation, which took effect at the start of the quarter. These benefits are perhaps most visible in the performance of our new mobile businesses. They contributed strongly to the group both operationally and financially. Our group postpaid net adds of 244,000 got the year off to a good start. And it was especially pleasing to see this alongside a record low postpaid churn of just 1% in EE. This week, we've also made the BT Sport app available to EE's postpaid customers too. On BT Sport, it was a record quarter with viewership up almost 60%. And finally, we've maintained a firm focus on the future, investing across the full breadth of our business, whether it's the superfast rollout, laying the foundations for GFAST and FTTP, or extending EE's already market-leading network coverage. Turning to slide five, I'll look at our future investments in more detail. In total, we're investing £6 billion over the next 3 years in UK fixed and mobile infrastructure. As part of that, we'll help take UK fibre broadband availability to 95% by the end of next year, and we want to go further. We're committed to further investment in ultra-fast broadband with an ambition to bring speeds of above 300 megabits per second to 12 million premises by 2020. We're also aiming to increase geographical 4G mobile coverage to 95% by 2020 from just over two-thirds today, bringing important benefits to rural communities. And we've made progress on building the emergency services network. This will support 300,000 members of the police, ambulance, fire and rescue, and other blue light services. Turning now to slide six, and firstly, to remind you of what we want to achieve at Openreach: better service, better coverage, and faster speeds. As you'll have seen on Tuesday, Ofcom published their proposal on the digital communications review. We welcome Ofcom's view that structural separation would be disproportionate, meaning that Openreach will remain 100% owned by BT. And Ofcom also recognised the need for effective corporate governance, such as the BT board setting the financial envelope for Openreach. On the same day, we published our plans to make Openreach more independent and transparent, introducing significant changes to meet their concerns. Firstly, we will establish a new Openreach board with an independent chair and a majority of independent members. Openreach will also control the deployment of capital with an overall budget agreed with BT's board. In addition, Openreach will produce an annual operating and a medium-term plan, underscoring its greater autonomy. There will be a formal three-stage process to consult industry in advance on substantial investment decisions and the development of new products. Finally, while Openreach will continue to have an obligation to serve all its customers equally, this obligation will be included in BT's Articles of Association, supplementing the current regulatory undertakings. We're encouraged by how much common ground there is between Ofcom and ourselves, but there are still important issues to resolve, and we will continue to engage with Ofcom over the coming months with the aim of reaching a fair, proportionate and sustainable regulatory settlement. Turning to slide 7, the other thing I wanted to spend some time talking about is improving customer experience. Firstly, we're focused on doing more things right first time to improve the customer's experience and to reduce the cost of failure. We're ahead on all 60 of Ofcom's minimum service levels, and we've improved the number of faults repaired in 2 working days from 68% 2 years ago to 84% today. We've reduced engineer missed appointments by more than a third since last quarter, and in consumer, all our customers can now expect repairs to be fixed 24 hours faster than before. Secondly, we're improving our network, not only extending the availability of fibre broadband and proactively maintaining our network to reduce faults, but also recruiting engineers, with 1,000 planned to join this year. And thirdly, we're making it easier to contact us. We're already taking on all EE brand postpaid calls in the UK and Ireland, and we're on track for 90% of BT consumer calls to be handled in the UK by March 2017. We're also improving and rolling out apps such as MyBT and MyEE to give customers more information at their fingertips. I'll now hand over to Tony, who'll take you through the financials.
Thanks, Gavin, and good morning. Just before I go into the results, I want to flag a couple of things. Firstly, we reorganised our lines of business on the 1st of April to better serve our customers. So the results today are for this new structure and compared against restated numbers. Secondly, as we only bought EE in January, we're comparing many of today's results against pro forma numbers for last year in order to provide a more helpful like-for-like comparison. Turning to slide 9, I'll cover our quarter one results. As Gavin said, it's been a good start to the year. EE integration is going well, and we've seen good financial and operational measures. Underlying revenue, excluding transit, was up 0.4% on a pro forma basis. That's after adjusting for a £47 million favourable impact from foreign exchange movements and a £14 million reduction in transit revenues. This growth was driven by consumer, which saw revenue up 9%, mainly driven by ARPU. Offsetting this, business and public sector faced headwinds with a number of public sector contracts completed, while wholesale and ventures faced a difficult prior year comparator that had benefited from ladder pricing revenue. EBITDA was down 2% on a like-for-like basis, reflecting our launch of BT mobile handsets and the benefit of ladder pricing in Q1 last year. These headwinds contributed to a 1% decline in earnings per share. Normalised free cash flow was up £342 million, reflecting the inclusion of EE and a smaller working capital outflow. And finally, our net debt was just under £9.6 billion, up £3.8 billion than last year, reflecting the acquisition of EE. So overall, a good start to the year. Now, on slide 10, I'd like to take you through the moving parts in EBITDA, where excluding the impact of FX, the handset launch, and ladder pricing, were broadly level in the quarter, despite the impact of the UEFA rights costs. The chart shows a walk from pro forma numbers for quarter one last year to this year. Firstly, we have benefited from a mild FX tailwind this quarter. Consumer also launched mobile handset packages, so we've seen an impact for our investments in the handset and in marketing. In Q1 last year, wholesale and ventures had a benefit from ladder pricing, so that's a headwind this year. Adjusting for these three items gives a fairer comparison on which to assess the quarter one performance. A new tougher set of price controls came into effect this quarter from the Business Connectivity Market Review, so we've seen an increased regulatory headwind from that. Within our business and public sector division, we've faced the challenge of a number of contracts completing. However, outside of public sector, it seemed solid growth. EE benefited this quarter from cost efficiencies, while global services also had a good quarter. This brings us to this quarter's EBITDA figure of £1.82 billion, which is broadly level year on year after adjusting for the three items on the left of the chart. Moving on now to operating costs on slide 11. Underlying operating costs, excluding transit on a pro forma basis, were up 2%. However, excluding the impact of consumers' mobile handset launch this quarter and the cost of the first season of UEFA Right, we saw a 1% decline. Within this, we saw a 2% decline in labour costs. We continue to be absolutely focused on our cost transformation programmes, and I'd like to walk you through some of the areas we're working on. So, turning to slide 12, we continue to make good progress in our cost transformation activities. We've commenced a project on improving the effectiveness of our software development unit by using new software to review our IT work as it is being applied. This will deliver annualised savings of around 16 million. In global services, we are rationalising our in-country support functions to create regional centres. This will deliver savings of over £10 million per year. We are improving the delivery of its support of its in-life support services outside the UK. This will deliver annualised savings of around £20 million. On contact centres, we continue to onshore direct customer service activity to the UK, with targets to handle 100% of EE and 90% of consumer customer service calls in the UK by the end of the financial year. This will result in around 1,900 new roles in UK contact centres. We continue to consolidate our back office activity within the BT service centre in India, and we will insource 1,400 roles this year. We continue to focus on improving the efficiency of the call centres by reducing the cost of failure, and will deliver around 70 million of savings, which will primarily be invested in improving customer service. These are just a few examples, but we have plenty of opportunities right across the business. We remain confident we can continue to reduce our cost base, and we still see well over £1 billion of gross cost-saving opportunities over the next 2 years. Turning to slide 13, integration is progressing well. We've started to deliver revenue and cost synergies in both the business and consumer markets. This quarter, consumer launched mobile handset plans, benefiting from EE's economies of scale in handset procurement. And just this week, we made the BT Sport app available to EE Pay Monthly customers. It's free for 6 months and then £5 a month on a rolling contract. And lastly, we're now insourcing a range of services that EE previously procured from third parties, doing them with our own people. For example, within IT and networks, we've completed a review of all contractors, which will contribute to over £12 million of synergies this year. And in contact centres, we're planning to insource 500 back office roles in the next 18 months. Finally, our BT Facilities Services team are taking over the responsibility for managing EE's offices and stores, delivering over 2 million of synergies and greater operational flexibility. So we're very much on track to deliver our revenue and cost synergy targets. Turning to slide 14, I'm going to touch on the pension. This quarter, the IAS 19 deficit has increased from 5.2 billion to 6.2 billion net of tax, driven by an increase in the liabilities. The last triennial review was done in June 2014. As you know, since then, interest rates have declined further to record lows. This reduces the discount rate used for the liabilities and therefore increases the deficit. As a reminder, the next triennial valuation is due to start in June 2017, following which we'll negotiate with the trustees around the level of prudence required on each of the assumptions and around the recovery plan. And a key point here is that our cash flow and covenant have been improved by the acquisition of EE. We're a stronger company with larger cash flow than in 2014, with a more diversified portfolio, which reduces risk. Turning to slide 15. Evidence of that improved covenant can be seen by the big three credit rating agencies, all having upgraded us to BBB+, or equivalent, since the acquisition in January. Our net debt at the 30th of June was 9.6 billion, down around 300 million since March. We've cancelled the EU's facility while increasing our facility from 1.5 billion to $2.1 billion, which remains undrawn. During the quarter, we repaid a $0.4 billion bond, and we have $2.4 billion in term debt repayable over the next 2 years. With our strong cash flows, that creates an opportunity for us to reduce our financing costs in the next few years. So, to finish, I'd like to remind you of our outlook for this year, and next on slide 16, which we're on track to deliver. And on that note, I'll hand you back to Gavin to take you through the line of business results.
Thanks, Tony. I'll now take you through each line of business. I'll start with consumer on slide 18. This was a good quarter. Revenue was up 9%, mainly driven by acceleration in broadband and TV, which was up 21%, though calls and lines also benefited from the contribution of additional BT mobile customers. We've continued to see a pickup in ARPU growth, with the growth rate to 8%, driven by broadband and TV growth, with ARPU broadly tracking the growth in RGUs per subscriber. As expected, EBITDA was down this quarter. The Q1 decline of 7% reflects the additional investment this year in our exclusive UEFA TV rights and the launch of our new pay-monthly BT Mobile handset contracts. Operating cash flow was up strongly, benefiting from phasing of UEFA rights payments. This strong financial performance is very much supported by solid operational stats. 79% share of broadband net adds follows on from 81% share last quarter, and 59,000 TV net adds takes our total TV base above 1.6 million. As you can see on slide 19, alongside the service improvements I touched on earlier, we're also continuing to improve our product offering. BT Mobile's pay monthly handset range is available on three simple plans with a discount for BT broadband households. We've been able to use EE's experience in mobile propositions to help refine the offers, and the two lines of business have worked together closely to generate the maximum market impact for the group as a whole. Something I wanted to call out is the launch of BT Smart Hub. This is a step forward for in-home Wi-Fi coverage and ensures our customers really get the most out of their broadband. Compared to the major UK broadband providers, the BT Smart Hub will always provide the most powerful Wi-Fi signal at any distance from the router. On test, when placed two rooms away, it was almost twice as fast as the Sky Q router. Something you'll appreciate even more when viewed over a powerful Wi-Fi signal is all the action on BT Sport. The UEFA Champions League and Europa League finals both attracted audiences of 6 million apiece, and for the first time, the matches were available across a wide range of digital platforms, something other broadcasters have now started to follow. Turning now to EE on slide 20. This was EE's first full quarter as a line of business within BT. Revenue was down a couple of percent on a like-for-like basis, or flat if you take out the impact of regulation. This was an improvement on the recent trend, despite the continued decline in the prepaid market. EBITDA, however, increased 11% on an underlying pro forma basis as the bottom line benefited from tight cost control. We'd expect the EBITDA phasing this year to be driven more by the timing of marketing and acquisition activity, which will likely to be different to last year. Operationally, a good postpaid net add result of 244,000, along with the prepaid reduction, brought the mobile base for the group overall to 30.3 million. It was also pleasing that our 4G base now extends to 16.7 million customers, and EE's postpaid churn was at a record low of 1%, reflecting our focus on improving service that I mentioned earlier. And to that end, we've now extended our 4G coverage to more than two-thirds of the UK's geographic area and 97% of the population. Turning now to business and public sector on slide 21. As we discussed at the Capital Markets Day, the trend in public sector has worsened as a result of the expected completion of a number of sizable contracts. As we said in May, the impact of these contracts will work through the business over the next 2 years. Elsewhere, as you can see from the chart, we've had a good performance from both UK SME and corporate. I'll also just remind you that in Ireland last year, we did call out one-off equipment sales as boosting growth. And we're seeing early evidence of revenue synergies from the integration of EE. For example, in the SME space, we saw a record net adds up more than 50% year-on-year on a like-for-like basis. Overall, this led BPS underlying revenue, ex-transit, to be down 4% like-for-like. Despite cost transformation activity, this was not enough to hold underlying EBITDA, which was down 5% on a pro forma basis. Operating cash flow was $252 million in the quarter, though this benefited from the timing of working capital movements. Order intake was up 11% in the quarter, or down 7% on a 12-month rolling basis. And this quarter, we signed a pan-London public sector procurement framework to provide a range of ICT products and services. On to global services on slide 22. Overall, this was a strong performance. Underlying revenue was flat. This was helped by strong results in the UK, where revenue was up 3%. Europe was up 2% underlying, delivering the seventh consecutive quarter of growth, underpinning how robust our business is against a backdrop of macro uncertainty that grew throughout the quarter. Revenue was up in EMEA, while Americas continued to decline due to the ongoing impact of a major customer in sourcing services. Our revenue performance translates into a 7% growth in underlying EBITDA. Our operating cash outflow of $283 million reflects the normal seasonality of the business and is very similar to the same period last year. We're also continuing to enhance a real source of product differentiation with our Cloud of Clouds proposition. This quarter, we have added Zscaler access points to our global network. These offer our customers lower latency and better performance over secure internet connections. Our order intake was down 11% against a strong prior year comparator, but with a higher proportion of the business being new or growth. And during the quarter, we signed contracts with customers such as Michelin, who are buying a managed service solution connecting 216 sites in more than 40 countries. Turning now to wholesale and ventures on slide 23. Underlying revenue, excluding transit, was down 6% like-for-like, of which broadly half was from the ladder pricing revenue we received last year, and which won't be repeated going forward. We've seen good growth in Ethernet and continued strength in fiber broadband this quarter, but have also had declines in higher margin partial private circuits. Ventures revenues continues to face headwinds due to the ongoing decline of payphones and directory services. However, the integration of the ventures portfolio into a single division is progressing well. We are focused on the cross-selling opportunities from bringing these operations together, and we expect to start seeing benefits in H2. Underlying operating costs were broadly flat, leaving pro forma EBITDA down 14% as the ladder pricing headwind flowed through, along with the deterioration in revenue mix. Order intake was down 7% in the quarter, but included a six-year deal with Daisy Communications for hosted Centrix services. And lastly, turning to Openreach on slide 24. Revenue was flat, with a bigger hit from regulation in the form of the recent BCMR, taking in total around $50 million out of the top line, which was offset by 33% growth in fiber broadband. Operating costs are up around 1% as a result of our focus on service and higher lever costs. This left Q1 EBITDA down slightly. Looking at the operational stats, the physical line base was 59,000 lower over the course of the quarter, with the sequential quarterly movement being slightly better than this time last year. Fiber, on the other hand, remains strong. 333,000 net adds is down on the prior year, but it's a good result. Overall, Openreach's fiber network now connects 6.2 million premises, all served on an open and equivalent basis. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, Openreach is currently ahead on all 60 of Ofcom's minimum service levels, which have stepped up in Q1 as we have entered the final year of the current fixed access market review. So, in summary, we've made a good start to the year. The integration of EE is progressing well, and we're starting to see some of the benefits to the group. We've delivered strong mobile KPIs, and our market share of broadband net adds was robust at almost 80%. BT Sport has gone from strength to strength this quarter, generating record viewing. Cost transformation remains core to our strategy, and there's plenty more to go for. And at the same time, we remain focused on improving customer experience, something that is front and center of activities in all our lines of business. We also continue to invest tirelessly to improve the UK's communications infrastructure, with plans to invest £6 billion across the converged fixed mobile landscape in the next 3 years. And just before we move to Q&A, I'd like to put on record my thanks to Tony. Although he's not heading off from BT for a few more months, this is his last results call. Tony's been has made a huge contribution to the business over more than 30 years, I think, and it's been nothing short of outstanding. And we will miss him very much. So on behalf of the whole company, thank you very much, Tony. And with that, I'll be delighted to take your questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, your question and answer session will now begin. If you do wish to ask a question or make any comments, please press star, then one on your telephone keypad. Your questions will be answered in the order received. You will be advised when to ask your question. Other lines will remain on listen only. Just to remind you again, for audio questions or comments, please press star, then one on your telephone keypad. The first question is coming from the line of Paul Marsh from Berenberg. Please go ahead, you're live on the call.
Morning, Paul.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you very much for taking the question. So I want to start with Ofcom and Openreach. Ofcom said the key differences between themselves and BT is that they want the Openreach CEO to report to BT Group CEO, and secondly, they had some concerns about confidentiality for Openreach decisions relating to CPs. Do you agree that those are the two big areas of difference? Are there any other areas of difference that you see from your side? And do you see room for negotiation around those specific issues, or are they red lines? And I wondered if I could maybe just add a question about DPA. If you've got a view on what the cost per home passed would be for BT to deploy FTTP using duct and pole access to 40% of UK households, as Ofcom would like to see competitors to do, if you have a view on the cost of that, and what kind of level of cost...
Hold on. Right, I think we've got two questions out there.
Sorry, thank you.
I will answer the question on the DCR, and then I'm going to pass it to Clive to give some comments on ducts and access and what we've been doing in that area. So on the DCR, I'm not going to conduct our discussions and negotiations with Ofcom in public. Let me be very clear about that. We were pleased that they chose not to pursue structural separation. That is a very sensible decision. It would not have led to better outcomes for customers, and it would have been a huge distraction over the next five, even potentially longer, years. In terms of what their ask is and what our proposal, I think I made it clear there's a significant overlap between what they want and what we're proposing, but there are significant differences that we need to work through before we get to an agreement. And whatever that agreement is, it needs to be completely consistent with company law, and reflect the fact that we will continue to be 100% shareholder of Openreach going forwards. So there is work to be done. It's a sensible set of proposals, but we will work through the areas of difference and try to bring it to conclusion over the next couple of months. On DPA, Clive.
On DPA, we are required by Ofcom to open up ducts and poles. The fact is, we actually did this 5 years ago. But we are evolving the processes by which other infrastructure builders can use the ducts and poles. We're in a trial period right now on a set of slicker processes, and we are going to provide a network map of ducts and poles for the UK as required by Ofcom. In terms of FTTP delivered over that passive infrastructure, look, I think it's very, you know, it's almost the wrong exam question to ask how much does it cost. It costs very different amounts of money dependent on the geography that you're delivering to. So if you're going to very rural places, you would expect it to cost a lot more than if you go to suburban places or urban places. So the price to deliver FTP varies enormously. Inside of Openreach, we've laid out a bigger ambition for FTTP. We have talked and we have a plan and we're executing on that plan to get to a 2 million footprint by 2020. We have tested our deployment processes, evolved those deployment processes, and we have slicker ways of delivering FTTP right now. So we're just going to focus on getting that job done and serving, in particular, business customers through FTTP, where we think there's a significant demand for a superior product. And by that, I don't mean just higher speeds. I mean a superior service wrap that meets the needs of business customers, which is why you're going to find us going to high streets and business parks across the UK. And perhaps one last focus area for FTTP will be on what we term multi-dwelling units, so apartment blocks. So we are very forensic in choosing the places for FTTP where we think demand will be particularly high combined with cost of deployment being particularly attractive. That's our plan and that's where we're going at.
Very good. Thank you, Clive.
Thanks.
Who's up next?
Thank you for your question there. Your next question comes from the line of Dan and Jay Merchandani from Bernstein. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my question. This is related to your portfolio of brands. So currently you have three, if not four, brands under your umbrella. How much room does your P&L have for these brands? And assuming that the EE brand stays within that portfolio, how do you expect to reposition EE and BT relative to each other in the medium term? Thank you very much.
We made it clear when we announced the acquisition of EE, and then we talked about this at the Capital Markets Day. We believe there's room for three brands in our portfolio going forwards. BT, EE, and Plusnet. We can realize a lot of the benefits, in fact, all the benefits from a network and systems synergy basis, but we also need to reflect that customer needs ultimately may not well be served from one single brand, and certainly the data backs that up. We can be considered by a significantly higher percentage of the market with three brands over any single brand, and that's not just true for our portfolio, it's true for anybody in the market. So you can get the full benefits of convergence, both in terms of from the cost side and the proposition side, but targeting the brands against specific customer groups, I think is the way forward for us. So in terms of where they'll focus, you know, BT's heartland is the household, and building out the relationship from the household, adding more family members through dual and triple play and ultimately quad play type propositions through convergence. EE's heartland is 4G and mobile and digital natives, and providing access to that type of customer into a wide range of products and services. And Plusnet is focused on smart, value-focused, self-serving customers, and we've demonstrated, I think, over the last 8 or 9 years where we've been the owner of Plusnet, that we're able to grow BT and Plusnet simultaneously in the market.
Thank you very much. Very clear.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Paul Sidney from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. It's just a question on the potential economy impact on BT going forwards. I saw your comments, Gavin, this morning that you've seen minimal impact from Brexit so far. But if the UK economy did worsen, which BT divisions do you think would be under most pressure, and actually which do you think would actually prove more defensive? Thank you.
Morning, Paul. I think it's too early to draw too many conclusions on Brexit. I mean, it was interesting. The only thing we noticed over the period was on the day of the vote itself, sales were a little quieter, and then everybody continued to buy the next day. There wasn't a particular drop in demand in our consumer business. So I think what the way we look at this is we have a balanced portfolio of businesses. Now, obviously, strength in the UK, but strength in markets I think that are important to the long-term health of the UK itself. And we've seen in previous recessions, if there is a recession in the UK over the next few years, that the consumer business, be that through BT or EE, is pretty resilient in those conditions. Our products and services are very, very important to the way people go about their daily lives or run their businesses, and they're not discretionary in many cases. So other things get cut before their core broadband and mobile needs. In the business market, there's a lot of change going on there. I think we've seen in the past that employment can have an effect in the business market, but I feel very confident that our competitive market position with the addition of mobile and the refocusing of our business around converged services and bundled services in business positions us very well. And it's a very fragmented market, so I think there's a chance to really drive market share, even in a market that could decline in a recession. So I think we're well placed there. And of course, global services serves more customers outside the UK than inside the UK. We've got a strong business in Europe. I think a sign of the confidence of some of our customers is that we signed a number of significant deals over the last few weeks. The only one we talked about in the press release was Michelin, and that was signed just a couple of days after the vote itself. And that is a French company serving 216 offices around the world, and they chose us over others. And I was delighted that there was nothing in the Brexit vote that put them off. So I think with global services, we have the opportunity to grow in not just Europe, but we've got a strong business in Asia-Pac, and potentially we can get it strong in the US as well. So I think we've got plenty of choice and flexibility in our business model. It's not to say that we're completely immune to it, but I think we're very well placed.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Maurice Patrick from Barclays. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Maurice here. So quick question on the process of the Ofcom strategic review. So Sharon White said on the radio that she believed Ofcom had the power to impose separation if it wanted to. Do you think Ofcom has the power to do it? And if they do decide to impose legal separation on you and you choose to appeal, can you walk us through the process by which you could challenge or look to overturn that or elements of it? Thanks.
I'm not going to get into that, Maurice, but good morning anyway. We've got a lot of common ground between Ofcom's ask and our proposal. There are issues to work through. I'm not in denial of that, but we will, we'll attempt to find a way forward on the areas that we differ at the moment. We should always remember that the last time I looked, we're still part of the EU, and Article 50 has not been triggered in any way. And as long as we're part of the EU, we need to respect EU regulations. And and indeed, depending on the type of relationship we want with the EU going forwards, if it is a Norway-style relationship, we will continue to need to respect European regulations. And that's significant because it's certainly our understanding, having spoken and taken a lot of legal advice on this, is that there is nothing within the European framework mechanism that would allow a forced separation of any company in telecoms.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question there. Your next question comes from the line of Andrew Lee from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead, you're live on the call.
Yeah, good morning everyone. Could you just talk through the potential drivers of the slightly weaker Group 5 net adds you saw this quarter? Yeah. How much, if any, was Project Lightning? How much was TalkTalk and Sky not marketing fibre as much? And are you seeing any rebound in the second quarter? And then just if you could speak on your BT retail fiber net adds, which were also modestly weaker. Is that a demand issue, an availability issue, or is it just that you've quite high take-up of fiber across your customer base now? Thank you.
Maybe I'll make a couple of opening comments and perhaps ask Clive and John to give some perspective from their businesses. I mean, overall, 333,000 net adds within the quarter at an Openreach level is not shabby. As you know, Andrew, the market does have a seasonal factor. What is our Q3 and our Q4 are the strongest quarters. And Q1 and Q2 are a little bit quieter. I think with respect to Virgin Media, we're seeing a little bit of impact around the edges, but not substantial at this stage. It's relatively early in the rollout still. It's around 500,000, maybe a wee bit more. They report next month, don't they? So maybe a little bit more in terms of the extra coverage they've built. But, you know, ultimately it's still a pretty competitive market. So, Clive, from your perspective, what are you seeing?
I think the numbers are reasonable. It is seasonal. So typically we see softer quarter in Q1 than in Q2. I think what we have to do in Openreach is focus on continuing to build the platform out so that there are more customers of the CPs that have super fast as an option for them, and we've had a good quarter on that. You know, we're on our commercial build target, we're on our BD UK target, and we're improving service to the customers who take the product. You know, missed appointments are down, time to repair is improved. I think as long as we do those underlying things, we build an ever more attractive platform for customers and for CPs to serve those customers from.
And John, you know, 79% market share, that's not shabby, is it?
No, similar picture to Clive, really. I mean, and the first quarter is normally a slightly slower quarter. That's been true this time. The driver of the fiber number is typically affected by just how much fiber regrowth marketing we do. There's a key difference versus the rest of the market. We haven't really migrated their existing customer base from copper to fiber. And this has been a very busy quarter for us because there's been the launch of the Smart Hub, there's been the launch of handsets, there's been the launch of a change in fibre speeds for our existing fibre customers from 38 meg to 52 meg. So there's been lots of stuff going on, a slight difference in focus, but no fundamental change in the drivers. The underlying consumer need for fibre and for fast broadband remains incredibly strong, I would say. And that's because consumers' usage continues to increase.
Very good. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Stephen Howard from HSBC. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Morning, Stephen.
Thank you. Morning, everybody. I was firstly just wondering whether you had seen from Ofcom a cost-benefit analysis of its proposals on legal separation, because I mean I think that would at least help us to evaluate how the regulator is assessing the practical impact of those aspects of the current arrangements with which it is unhappy. And my second question is on rural. Obviously, a source of a lot of the criticism of Openreach is the quality of the rural service. Now, plainly, a lot of that just reflects the harsh realities of physics. But nonetheless, it's a very contentious topic. The government and Ofcom seem agreed that a 10 megabit per second USO is appropriate. And so what I wanted to know is how quickly you think you might be able to get that done with your new technologies like long reach VDSL. In other words, you know, how quickly can that very contentious topic be addressed?
Let me answer the first question about cost-benefit analysis, and then I'll pass to Clive on rural. The answer is no. Clive.
Okay, so I was reading a report from Think Broadband yesterday that says that super-fast coverage of the UK is now at 91%. We are very confident that we will underpin the government's target of getting us to 95% by December 2017. all the plans we have underpin the government target, so confident on that one. We are very, very focused on a detailed plan for how we would deliver a minimum of 10 megs to the remainder. Long reach VDSL is core to the technology mix that we would use. It's been at trial in one location in Sussex. The results are as we'd expected based on the lab experiments. We are now enabling cabinets in various parts of the country in order to do a much bigger scale trial, just to prove that at scale this technology will meet the USO for a very large number of customers. My ambition is that we lay a plan that we then talk to government about that talks about delivering the 10 meg and above promise, and it is a 10 meg and above promise. You know, the idea is not to deliver 10 megs to 5% of the population, but to deliver that as the minimum. And we would, our aspiration would be to do that as quickly as 2020 if we can get the right terms for that investment program.
And of course, it's not just about fixed. We're obviously the biggest mobile provider in the UK, and the rollout of the emergency services network contract will ensure that we'll get to 95% geographical coverage with 4G by 2020. And I think that will help to address some of the criticisms that sometimes we get to hear.
Thanks, Gavin. Having really succinct.
Very good. Next question, please.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Nick Lyle from SocGen. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Hi, Nick.
Hello, Gavin. Morning. Just a couple, please, if that's okay. On Stephen's question there, could you, if you've not got their cost-benefit analysis, could you help us a little bit with your view on the costs? I mean, you've mentioned in the release today that a legal subsidy could be disproportionate. So which of the costs of employee asset transfers, tax and pensions are we should we really think about? And, you know, have I just missed any out that you think is really significant in that? And then the second one would be on consumer, please. Could you give us a little bit of a background on what seems like a good performance from yourselves, but maybe a weak market? Are you still seeing that continue? We're only 2 weeks away from the football season, so is there a chance that there's a materially lower marketing spend this time versus last time around? Thanks.
I'll let John comment on the consumer market in a second. Look, in terms of the costs of legal separation, there are the costs around changing contracts, changing way leaves, around systems and separating systems. And of course, there will be costs associated with people if we move the 32,000 Openreach employees into a separate legal entity. So they are quite significant. We would argue, to Stephen's earlier point, that the cost-benefit is analysis needs to really justify something like that. I mean, the people cost, just for clarity, will be related to the pension, the additional pension costs that we would expect the trustees to ask for at that point. So there is a bit of work to be done to go through these. Ofcom are very clear in the document and were in all the briefings that they do not want to substantially increase BT's costs. And so we feel as though there's an opportunity to really talk this through with them and help them understand the cost-benefit analysis that they'll ultimately, I'm sure, want to provide. And then I was going to pass to John for the consumer market.
Yeah, in terms of the market this quarter, we're not really seeing very many substantial differences versus previous years. I mean, there are some very aggressive offers out there. Sky are promising free fibre for life for customers that take Sky Sports. There's a new bundle from Now TV that includes a 30-day contract. Virgin Media have got posters pretty much everywhere that talk about the benefits of giving BT Sport and Sky Sports from one place. So these are sort of pretty similar characteristics to what we've seen in prior years, and I don't really see much of a change, I have to say.
Very good.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Robert Grindle from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Morning, Robert.
Yeah, good morning. You flagged in the presentation the strengthening balance sheet. Given the share price weakness post-Brexit, were you tempted to add more to the existing buyback program, which was more or less fully executed? I think you are allowed to do so within the agreement with the pension trustees. And then one for Tony, and by the way, good luck, and also to your successor. You have a lot to be proud of as your time at the CFO, but any regrets? What would you have done differently if you'd had your time again?
Nice. Thank you very much, Robert, for that one. Actually, I'll ask Tony on both of them, if that's okay. Give you the next time.
Sure. Thank you, Gavin. Robert, in terms of the buyback, we've primarily used the buyback vehicle as a means of preventing share dilution in relation to employee shares, and we declared that strategy a number of years back, and we're not looking to move from that strategy. In relation to regrets, I think potentially we may have done a bit more de-risking when the market was more in our favour in relation to the pension deficit, but hindsight's always a great thing.
Thank you, Tony.
Very good. Next question, please.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Mandeep Singh from Redburn. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Hi, Mandeep.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking the question. I really wanted to sort of understand a little bit more about what's going on, the order intake in some of the, you've talked about the cyclical impact already, but, you know, order intake in a number of areas does actually look like it's worsening. Are you just seeing a general slowdown, so nothing to do with Brexit, but just a general slowdown? Could you just talk about what's going on, particularly business and public sector looks quite weak in terms of order intake, global services? I know you've talked about some of the contracts and not being affected by Brexit, but so just want to understand a bit more about the order intake dynamics, because business and enterprises are sort of an area in some of the other telcos in Europe, TDC, KPN, and some others, which are seeing some big secular pressures as we move from sort of traditional services to new IP-based services. I'd just like to understand a few of the dynamics there, please.
Sure. I'm going to ask Graham and Lewis perhaps to add a couple of words, but from my perspective, I think what we're seeing is on the corporate side, be it major business, SME, or SOHO, actually the business is strong. It is, and the order book is pretty good. The order book does move around a little bit. It can be pretty lumpy depending on whether there are deals in big deals in the baseline period, because they don't come through at a regular rate. If I look at the sense of the business and its predictability and actually in all those markets, it's looking good. The drag, and we called it out in the capital market days, is the public sector business, where big contracts are coming to an end, and we will work through that over the next couple of years. We've reorganized our business to take advantage of what we think will be the way procurement moves moving forwards, moving more regional, looking to leverage the full range of products and services across multiple segments that we can offer in the UK, taking full advantage of the integration of mobile as well. So I think we're well positioned as the market turns, but ultimately that's going to take a year or two. So, Graham, do you want to talk on UK domestic to start with, business and public sector, and then Lewis on global services?
Okay, thank you, Gavin. There's probably three things worth saying. And in terms of the business and public sector division, over the last couple of years, we've had a couple of very substantial renewals, and they're long-term, 5-7-year contracts, particularly in the Republic of Ireland. So they obviously don't repeat on a regular basis. We've also lost or discontinued three public sector contracts. They're fairly sizable, and therefore we didn't have any renewal order book from those. But if you strip that out, the actual underlying position is relatively strong, and we're seeing that, particularly with ex-public sectors, we're seeing it with strong growth in both our SME and corporate markets. So underlying business is strong.
Good.
Yep, thank you. I think that if you look to a couple of years ago, we are around 20% above 2 years ago. Against last year, there's a little bit of variability because it was a very large still, we see quite a strong performance all across the regions. We are very pleased with the results. I think that we have seen customers continue to give us confidence, as you mentioned, on Michelin and some of the others deals that we have announced today and over the quarter. So I think that it's still quite a good performance in terms of the order intake, and the pipeline looking ahead looks pretty solid as well.
And Jerry, anything from the wholesale market?
Yeah, in wholesale there was a tough comparator with the last quarter and the corresponding quarter last year with an EE order that came in, so there's a significant change there. But overall the pipeline, and you look at the long run, is not significantly different. I don't think there's anything to concern there.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, guys. That's very helpful.
Thank you. Who's up next?
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Simon Whedon from Citigroup. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Morning. Thank you for taking the call. Yeah, so I guess I've got a couple of questions. One is whether you see scope for variations on what legal separation of Openreach could mean. So, for example, whether or not it's binary, whether or not Openreach directly employs all its staff or directly owns all of its assets, for example. And on broadband, if I could add to the line of questions on that, we seem to be seeing a slowing in the market as a whole. The market share seems to be holding up quite well, but is this sort of, I know you've addressed this in different ways, but I think this is a different question, is this slowing of the market something that is the new normal? And when are we likely to hear more from you on the deployment of GFast? Thanks.
Very good. I'm going to ask certainly Clive, John, and I don't know whether you wanted to add anything on the market on broadband in a second. In terms of incorporation, you know, I'll just repeat what I said at the beginning of the day. I don't want to conduct negotiations in public around the future of Openreach and the governance around Openreach. There are clearly a range of different variants of incorporation, and Ofcom, as I said, were very clear that they do not want to significantly increase the costs that Openreach has to incur, because unlike other industries, we do not get to reclaim the pension payments to repair the deficit in the charge control that we offer. So, you know, I think that's a very sensible position. We will discuss a range of different solutions with Ofcom, and hopefully we'll be able to come to a sensible, pragmatic, sustainable way forward. Market views, Clive, what's your sense?
So underlying, I do believe customers over time will migrate to higher speed services. You know, the reference point for me is ADSL2. Just in rough numbers, only 50% of ADSL2 customers can receive 10 megs, right? As customer use of broadband increases, as applications demand higher bandwidth, as the propensity to stream high-definition video continues to increase, I think there will be inexorable pressure to move customers to a super-fast and ultimately an ultra-fast platform. So I think all the underlying reasons why growth of the customer base on super-fast, that all of those underlying reasons are not going away. So, you know, I do believe we'll build and continue to build. If you add to that that our footprint is extending, you know, almost 25,000 new homes every week can now benefit from the platform. I think those underlying forces will keep the numbers moving in a healthy way. If I could then switch, if I may, to the GFast question. So we're very pleased with the results that we've got from the early trials in Cambridgeshire and in the northeast at Gosforth and in South Wales at Swansea on GFast. We've made our supplier selection. We've laid out what we term our pilot plan. So these are significant scale pilots in Kent and Cambridgeshire. Our intention is to put in a platform footprint of 25,000 homes passed in Q3 of this year and to launch thereafter. So we're very positive about what GFast will achieve. It is a mechanism for us to deliver an ultra-fast platform at real pace
to a very large number of people in the UK, and the plan is on schedule to the dates that I've just given you.
Thanks, Clive. John, any other observations?
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts. Firstly, the household penetration in the UK is it's pretty high already, so at some point the number of the new households taking broadband, that was bound to start to slow down. There is a seasonal aspect of this, though, that we said, and typically quarters three and four are generally bigger quarters. But the real trend here, I would say, is that from the retail point of view, for some years this has been primarily a switches market, and the services that BT is selling through its several brands compete very well in that switches market through differentiation and through competing at different price tiers. And then secondly, and the point I made earlier, in terms of the underlying trend that we see, is for bandwidth users to increase very substantially year on year. And just as Clive was saying, that shows that the demand for better broadband, for fibre broadband, is extremely strong.
Very good. We've got time for one more question. This is the final question.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of James Ratzer from New Street Research. Please go ahead. You're live on the call.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. Thanks for making the last question. Hope they can live up to expectations then. So two, please. One, we've now owned EE for 6 months. We're just wondering if you could give us an update on how you are finding the idea of cross-selling both in the business and also in the consumer market. And second, I noticed lever costs in the quarter were up quite sharply year on year. I was wondering if you could help give us a steer on how lever costs should pan out for the rest of the year. Many thanks.
Very good. I'm going to ask Tony, as his last ever answer on a BT investor call, to talk about lever costs. Do you want to handle that first, and then maybe Graham, a word on cross-sell in the business market. Lewis, if you've got anything out from your perspective, John, Mark, just a couple of words on each. Okay, levers.
The position on levers is actually good news because it means that we're progressing well in terms of our rationalisation programmes. The $40 million we incurred is not, I wouldn't go with that number all the way through. I think we'll have it'll obviously reduce because we're trying to get the savings in early.
Very good. Cross-sell in SME and corporate in the UK, Glenn?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the early signs are very positive. We've obviously fully integrated the teams, and you know, improved our coverage and distribution, and we're seeing, you know, increased acquisition both on fixed and mobile. So early signs are positive.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that the customers are really accepting very well, and they're very supportive on using both. I think convergence is really driving that, and we have seen that both in the financial services sector as well as some of the other large brands, and the increased use on data, I think, is quite important in a way of driving this cross-selling, so it's working really well.
John?
The approach on cross-sell for the consumer market is very much to use the most effective brand for the right customer, and so typically for BT broadband customers, the approach is to cross-sell the EE mobile network through the use of the BT mobile brand. I think you can see through the postpaid net adds and through the broadband market share that there's strong trading momentum. There's one exception to that, and that is that BT Sport's been sort of given to EE customers now, and I think that's a strong offering that fits logically for consumers, and it's going to be good things for Mark's business, hopefully.
Nice segue, Mark.
Yeah, great segue, John. Thanks. Yeah, I was going to say the highest profile example we've got launched today. So BT Sport and EE, that's a great example. You know, we're learning a lot across the businesses on home and mobile as we share knowledge, and that's helping us achieve best practice in both areas.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. So on behalf of everybody at BT, hopefully you'll get a chance to get a little bit of time off over the summer, and we look forward to seeing you for the Q2 results.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes your conference for today. You may now disconnect. Thank you for joining. Enjoy the rest of your day.